From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Well, if you grew up around guys like Francis Ford Coppola and Terrence Malick, the odds are you're going to become a filmmaker at some point in your life. My guest, who had a sort of like a run-in with acting before he found his true bent as a filmmaker, is Emilio Estevez, whose new film as director is The Public. First of all, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Elvis. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
My pleasure. And one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is that some of the films that you directed, be it Bobby or Rated X with The War at Home, which we just talked about a bit before we got started, The Public, or even the guy. So much of the stuff, even Men at Work, these films are about kind of an emotional PTSD, aren't they?
Well, indeed. And I think that the one aspect of life, I think, that connects all of us is a shared trauma. Nobody walks the planet pain-free. We all carry a certain amount of trauma with us. And I think that is ultimately what connects us in our humanity is a shared pain.
But that idea of trauma being so central to these stories that you're attracted to as a filmmaker, it seems to be unique to you that's the same. Even something like Wisdom, which is kind of about suffering through that kind
right,
of thing,
about right.
In fact the impact that violence has on people in this country.
That's right.
Is something that you gravitate towards as a filmmaker.
That I do, and I it's not unique. Certainly, the trauma is not unique to me, but
you've made every film you've made has been about wrestling with the impact of violence in one way or another.
That's right. That's right. And it's not that I grew up in a violent home. I grew up with two very loving parents who, had their issues like any family does, but they're still very much together. But again, I was born in 1962. I came up watching the violence on television. Of course, living through the assassinations of Dr. King and Bobby, and the Democratic National Convention unraveling in Chicago, and all of those images, all of that imagery coming through the television as a young boy, when you are at your most impressionable. And you're seeing those images over and over, images of the Vietnam War, wondering if the war continues, if your lottery number is going to get called up. So all of that, I believe, informs the types of stories that I gravitate towards and to now.
No, I think it's so interesting because so often there is somebody who's been damaged by that who refuses to change. I mean, in the character that Alec Baldwin plays here is kind of that guy.
That's right.
And we could say that the character your dad played in The Way is that guy.
That's right.
At some way or another, there's somebody who's been so damaged and refuses to change his point of view.
That's right. Oh, and when you think about, too, let's talk about Bobby for one second.
Sure,
of course. You know, a lot of critics came after him. They said, well, it wasn't the biopic that they were expecting. Because of the title,
but it wasn't about Bobby.
It was about what we lost when we lost Bobby. It was about the collective national trauma of that, what a lot of people call the third strike after Jack in Dallas and then King in April and then Bobby soon thereafter
in June.
It was the third strike. And the national trauma that we felt was really what was the movie, what the film was about. It was about what life looks like without Bobby Kennedy. And now, of course, we know.
But also, there's so much, too. And again, what Bobby was about is what we're talking about, what I started the conversation with, dealing with a kind of a PTSD that, and we see the uptick in gun violence in this country now.
That's right.
We really are kind of feeling almost a national version of that, aren't
That's
we?
That's right. We are. We need to, I think, start putting, and it's not just semantics, we need to start calling things for exactly what they are. Bill McKibben, the climate scientist, talks about it's not climate change. We're in a climate crisis. We're in a gun violence crisis. We're in a homelessness crisis. And until we start putting those words on it, I think that allows us to get to the reality of the situation and say, okay, let's call this a crisis. And now how do we solve it? How do we solve that crisis collectively? And there has to be a will on behalf of the people to go after these issues that are plaguing the country.
It's true. My guess, the first person who ever name-checked Bill McKibben is Emilio Estevez. His new film as writer, director, and actor is The Public. But one of the things, too, that these films so often, not so often, always deal with is how it's recognized by men versus women. You know, the kind of the men so often close themselves off.
That's right.
It becomes almost this kind of free. And I wonder if this is the case for you, almost like an archetype way of being masculine and not saying I'm too strong to be buckled by this and not admitting that there's a trauma.
Well, I think that we are, you know, men in general are bound in this sort of false sense of hyper masculinity and what we think it means to be a man. And I think what we're seeing is the end of the patriarch, because it's just not sustainable, and the world is reverting back to the matriarch. The earth is female, and I think that when 3,000 years ago, when women controlled the villages and the communities, they were thriving. Enter the male dominance, enter the male will, and things have been unraveling since. But really, for the last 3,000 years, with the well, we know.
Yeah,
we know. We're seeing it, and it's no, it's really no question what's happening now. What we're seeing in, with the Me Too movement, what we're seeing with all the various political candidates, female political candidates stepping up and taking charge, and I think we're going to be looking at a very different next couple of hundred years.
I think so.
With
too.
This empowerment that I'm all for. I mean, my mother was the center of our. Is the center of our family. And my dad likes to, you know, walk around, and he's still got his swagger. He'll be 79 this year, but he's still, you know, he's on Grace and Frankie. He's still working. They're in their sixth season. And he likes to think he's in charge, but no, it's my mom. And she always, you know, she was born in Cincinnati, and my dad was born in Dayton. And they didn't meet in Ohio, but they met years later in New York. She got a scholarship to the New School as a fine painter, fine artist.
Okay.
And then he, of course, went to New York to study acting and to be discovered. And they had a mutual friend. My dad was sleeping on his couch, and he said, "Hey, I got a gal for you." And I think he just wanted him off the couch. And so they. They started dating. They hated each other. Well, actually, my mom hated him.
And, she hated
but,
him?
But yet, yeah, she thought he was a bum. And so, but he was convinced that if she saw him in the play that he was currently doing, that she'd fall in love with him. And she came to see it. And, of course, she did. And they were living together 3 weeks later.
What was the play?
It was called The Connection.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, he was playing a junkie.
Yeah, famous play about junkies. Wow. Yeah, Shirley Clarke did the movie about that.
That's right.
It's interesting, too, because I guess... You're talking about what you grew up in, and so many of the roles that your dad is famous for, you coming up, stuff like That Certain Summer or The Exclusion of Private Slovak,
that's right.
were also takes on ways of trying to bring down that archetypal masculinity,
that's
weren't
right.
they?
That's right. Slovak specifically was about an act of civil disobedience or conscientious objection to fighting
World War II.
World War II. And Eddie Slovak paid for it with his life. That Certain Summer, again, both Levinson Link shows, if you recall, they were
Absolutely.
Right on the edge of doing some really important television at the time.
And this was network TV, we should say, too.
Network TV. It's when the movie of the week was the movie of the week and was ultimately replaced with independent film in the 80s. It's sort of that movie of the week model went away. When you think about some of the great directors that Steven Spielberg directed, Duel, that was a movie of the week.
Sure.
So there were a lot of wonderful directors that came out of that training ground of having to shoot a film in 15 days for the network.
And making it play. But I guess I was thinking, too, because I wondered that had an impact on you, too, the kinds of things your dad was doing that were really asking questions. It, certainly, even Badlands, we could say, in Apocalypse Now, we're asking
That's
questions
right.
about the trap of that kind of toxic masculinity. And that couldn't help but have an effect on you as a storyteller, could it?
Indeed. And you know, I think that for me, just the very fact that I was present, I got to spend an entire summer in La Junta, Colorado, watching Terry Malick work. Again, really not knowing what was going on other than just standing there and absorbing it and watching an artist, you know, paint his canvas, which Terry is, you know, he does obviously wonderfully. And then a few years later at 14, being on the set of Apocalypse Now and growing up, I was there for about 6 months and watching how Francis Coppola was doing it. And then only, you know, 4 years later to be on the set working with him on The Outsiders. It was a great training ground. It was very eye-opening. And it was a real life in terms of how I wanted to live my life. It's sort of like being in the circus. You go into a town, you set up the tents, you put on a show, you break it down, and you move on. And so this nomadic life for me was something that it still thrills me. I still love being on the road.
Do you?
I love being, yeah, I love
just
traveling.
Talked before, you still drive a lot around the country.
I love to drive around the country. I sold my house here in Los Angeles in 2016. I sold it with all the furnishings. I packed up what amounted to be 2.5 pieces of luggage, put them in my car, and drove to Cincinnati to make the public. So I didn't really have a plan B. There was only plan A: go to Cincinnati, put all of this funding together, and make the film.
But I think that so much of what you're doing, though, and being especially going to Cincinnati and seeing a place that's trying to right itself.
That's right.
Because it's damaged by the fall of the industrial the car industry and the manufacturing.
Indeed, and you're from Highland Park, so you know that city suffered massively. I mean, think about it now. I think there's still unpaid water bills in Highland Park. The streetlights still haven't been.
They don't really have a water department. They've outsourced all that stuff because there's no money in the infrastructure.
That's right. Library's closed.
Library I grew up going to.
What's the name of it again? Is it?
It's the McGregor Public Library.
McGregor, that's right. That's right. I just saw a picture of that recently. And we're stopping. You know, I'm on this tour right now where we're going from city to city. It's a 30-day grassroots tour for the public. And we're stopping at libraries along the way. The tour ends in New York City, April 1st, where we're going to screen at the New York Public Library, the 42nd Street branch in downtown Manhattan. But along the way, I've gone visited a library in Seattle, libraries in Kansas City, in Salt Lake City. Librarians are screening for homeless advocacy groups, screening for social workers. And the response to the film has just been, it's been really, really fabulous.
So if you spend time in libraries, as I do, you've seen what libraries have become, especially over the last 20 years.
That's
man.
Right.
There's a real shift in what libraries have become as the homeless populations have grown around this
country.
That's
right. That's right. It's what Eric Kleinenberg has a new book called Palaces for the People. And he talks about how libraries are the cornerstone of what he's coined social infrastructure. Social infrastructure can be public parks, public green belts, public libraries, anywhere where the public congregates, and that how important they are and how important libraries are, because they are the great equalizer in terms of class stratification. You know, you and I have access to computers and cell phones, and we have access to information. But imagine if you are on the street, you're an individual experiencing homelessness, and you have 2 hours to get into that library, A, get out of the cold, B, get online, look for a job, look for housing, contact your loved ones, tell them you're still alive. Those 2 hours are vital in your communication with the outside world and staying in step with the rest of the people on the planet, essentially. So we forget how vital libraries are. Librarians were the first Google, when you think about it, right? And so it's really important that we continue to invest in that social infrastructure, that we continue to build and not allow privatization of those spaces to occur. So it's been a collective unraveling that has gotten us to this place. And then we criminalize people for being poor, for being on the street, where we other them.
It's really become Dickens, hasn't it? Where there's everything but a jail for poor people.
That's right. That's right. Well, you know, we got to figure this out. We got to figure out housing first, because you can't get well until you get off the street. And so permanent supportive housing is the first step towards getting well.
We're going to take a break. I'm going to hope my guest can get a little bit better himself in the next half of the show. It's The Treatment. I'm talking to Emilio Estevez, whose new film is writer, director, and actor is The Public. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. My guest who's taking a welcome swallow is Emilio Estevez. He's starring and wrote and directed the film The Public. It's The Treatment. I guess what I thought, too, so interesting, it's such a great title.
Thank you.
It's a really great title, and it sort of says a lot and evokes a lot. And talk about where the title came from. Is it?
Well, it was there was some pushback initially. The people said, well, you know, what is the public? Well, it's the public library. Was that a nickname? Well, it's not. It's really about us. It's really we the public, we the people. But it is also the public library. And I think it just speaks across all lines to say this is what this film is about. It does take place in the library, but it's but a library is essentially just a building with some books in it without the staff and the patrons to occupy it. That's the most valuable asset of the public library. It goes home every night, which is the staff.
Yeah, but it's interesting too because it exists as. Even for people who don't go to libraries, it exists as kind of an ideal for them, doesn't it?
It does. And I think it's, you know, we have an idea. But we also, you know, we also hold, I think, a special place for libraries because it evokes certain memories. The stacks, for me anyway, as a boy, were a very safe place to go where I could explore my curiosity. I mean, now we look up a word and we go right to Google and we get that boom, that instant hit. Back in the day, you picked up a dictionary and you, on your way to finding that word, you may stop 10, 15 times. Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, that's interesting. So your curiosity was stoked. And by the time you got to the word, it was like, oh, yeah, that too, right? And the same thing with an encyclopedia. You're looking up a subject and you stop along the way. I miss that. And I think that young people miss that as well. I think that there's a lack of curiosity, and there's that again goes back to that immediate hit, that instant gratification, and that's kind of where we are right now.
Also, the thing that libraries did, and there's a section where your character reads from Grapes of Wrath, and I just remember hearing those words. Just remember finding that book in the library for the first time. But there's a thing that happens too in the library where you just get lost in kind of in imagination. And there's also, there used to be a calm in libraries.
That's right.
And this movie is kind of about that sort of oasis aspect of libraries disappearing as they become necessary encampments where people don't have any place else to go.
That's right. And that is what's happening. What you see in the film is indicative of what's happening across the country in libraries. We took the film down to the ALA convention, the American Library Association convention, in New Orleans last June. We screened for about 3,000 librarians. And of course, that was the screening that I was the most nervous about because I felt if we didn't get it right with librarians, we were absolutely screwed. But the first question was, how did you get us so right? How did you nail librarian the daily life of a librarian? How did you get it so right? And my answer to that was that I just sat and observed and kept my mouth shut, because I think that is as a researcher, which is what I was during the research phase, getting the materials together, enough material to write the story. It was acting as a researcher first and spending time in libraries and putting a hoodie on so that I could quietly observe and not be recognized and just surrendering to it. And that was sort of a big step for me. Be curious, but also keep my mouth shut and just listen.
But we're talking about this, I was even thinking that have also seized on these kind of sprawling emotional tales. I have a lot of people in The Way had a big cast. Mm-hmm. A lot of people in that.
That's right.
A lot of people, a lot of moving parts in that. And that idea of tackling something that really this kind of emotional, what seems like an emotional sprawl, but in fact is these intersecting stories, sounds incredibly daunting, especially given probably in each of these projects you had really truncated shooting schedules.
That's right. Spain, we shot the Way. We actually had 40 days.
Did you?
To shoot that picture. Bobby was about 40 days too. This is the shortest period of time that
I've
had.
But these are still pretty short schedules given how many people there
are
in these
movies. Yes, indeed.
I'm sorry.
Absolutely.
I don't mean to tell you. No, you're right. You're taking way too much time. Make a 10-day movie with all these people.
Right.
But there's something about having that many people. I wonder if you like that. So creating what's almost in effect like a stage play.
That's right.
You're bringing people together, bringing talents together who have a pretty sort of concise point of view as actors.
That's right.
And waiting for that kind of friction that comes out of that. That's something you kind of gravitate towards too, isn't
it? I dig it. I dig the process. That is my favorite part of it. I'm a problem solver. And I think every day on the set, you start with, okay, what problems am I going to be presented with today? What level of compromise am I going to have to accept? Because that's what filmmaking really is. It's a series of compromises. And what Danny DeVito calls, when he was directing a Death by a Thousand Questions, every day you just never know what's going to come at you. This is the first sort of big role that I've played in one of my films in quite a while. I didn't want to wait for someone to come out of the trailer, so it was something that I decided to take on. Early days when we were trying to put this film together and it fell apart, it was suggested that it was too big of a canvas, that I should perhaps hire somebody else to play Stuart, and I considered that, and I considered playing one of the other roles. But as time went on and as I marinated in this material and as I began to really embrace the idea of playing Stuart, it was he's probably the closest character that I've ever played to me.
Including being a farmer.
Including that. Yeah. Yeah.
And you can also see, too, that for him, it's about having a home, having a place he can put his hands on something, get his hands
that's
into
right.
the ground. And that I know that you do that, and that's got to have that same kind of healing power for you as well, doesn't it?
It does. The Amish say that every day that you get your hands in the ground, into the earth, you're closer to God. And so I love getting my hands dirty. I love getting them into the soil. I love growing things. I love the miracle of watching a seed become something that is ultimately on your plate. That is something that I will never stop marveling at. But for Stuart, it's in the film, growing things is a replacement for, and books are a replacement for his addictions. Many times when people get sober, they need to transfer that energy that they put into getting high into other things. And I've also thought that the growing of the tomatoes and the basil was part of that, but it was also connected to Grapes of Wrath,
which is
a book that lives in literally in his memory. And by the way, Grapes of Wrath is going to celebrate its 80th anniversary this year. It was published April 14th, 1939, first time. And it was, a lot of people don't see it as this, but it's an environmental novel. It opens with the Dust Bowl and ends with the flood.
But so much of Steinbeck is that. You
That's
can
right.
say East of Eden is that. You can say Cannery Row is that.
That's
they're
right.
kind of all about environments and about community. And it's funny because I was going to ask you about that, because so much of Steinbeck is about faith and finding faith. And every movie you've made, even Men at Work, even Wisdom, is about at some point somebody trying to find a way to believe in something bigger than themselves.
That's right.
And is that a conscious thing for you as a storyteller, that faith, that article of faith, that moment of transcendence, it has to be, if not discovered, then certainly part of a de facto search for a character?
Well, I think that it's probably some of that. I also think it's, I've chosen a more difficult path. As a filmmaker, I don't go for the obvious. I don't imagine going from office to office here in this town and say, I'm going to make a movie about a library and there's going to be some homelessness folks in it. We're going to deal with mental illness. And you just see the glaze go over the eyes of the executives and they shake their heads and they say, well, can't you just make another hockey movie? Or can't you just, you live here, you see what goes on. You see the product that is churned out of here. It's not, there's not a whole lot of imagination or courage.
But you came up seeing the way your dad worked and even the kind of things he made in TV that were, all these things were basically sort of boats against the current.
That's right.
You know, so much of what
That's
he
right.
did. And you saw that example of that, even just sort of torch this metaphor a little further, that if you had faith in the material, that you would find a way to bring it to fruition.
That's
to,
right.
To market it, if you will.
That's right.
And so it seems like faith not only becomes a compact in the storytelling, but in your own pursuit of the story as well.
It does. And it also is part of, I think, my own demons that I fight against. You know, when I'm out on a hike or if I'm on a drive and I'm thinking, man, if I could just, you know, I know these jokes will land. I know this character will land with people. I know that if I get the opportunity to make this film. It will land with audiences. And now I'm standing in the back of the theater, and whatever I was imagining on that, you know, somewhere on that road between LA and Cincinnati, you know, somewhere in the deepest parts of Nebraska, you know, I'm out on that I-80, and I'm thinking, if I could just have, you know, if I could just convince people that this movie will land, that these jokes will land, I'll prove it to them. And so there's that, right? And so now to be standing in the back of the theater and to have those jokes actually land, I feel a little less crazy.
But it actually brings to mind for me a question I want to ask you, and this will be my last question, and I'm sorry because time has gone so fast, but I want to talk to you about your memories of your first day as a director shooting Wisdom versus your first day on this set.
Oh, Lord. I had such an ego on Wisdom.
I was 20. Your first film as a director.
First film as a director. I was 23. I had experienced a situation two years before, a picture that I had written but did not direct. And
that was in This Is Now.
That was in This Is Now.
You said we're not just making a reference. That's actually
that's the film. And so when I got to make my first film, I was surrounded by an extraordinary team. I had Robert Wise, who was my executive producer. Danny Elfman was my composer.
His first score.
I think he did Pee Wee's Big Adventure before he
was
did.
Was that just before? Okay.
But I had stood outside the theater where he was performing here in Hollywood, and I said, you know, Mr. Elfman, someday I'm going to direct the movie, and I want you to do the score. And he was like, who are you? But he was very sweet, and right? So it was Danny Elfman doing the score. Michael Kahn, who was Steven Spielberg's
editor,
cutting the film. Bernard Williams was my producer, who was
Linden. You guys start with Stanley Kubrick.
That's right. So Dennis Gassner was our production designer. It was I had this brain trust of these incredible individuals. Adam Greenberg, who just shot The Terminator, was its cinematographer. So again, this depth, my bench was so deep. And I was 23, and I was an absolute asshole. And nobody could tell me anything. And even though I understood fundamentally that filmmaking it takes a village, filmmaking is a community effort, I had my hands were so tightly gripped around a particular vision that, you know, when you look at a closed hand, what gets in? Absolutely nothing. When you open that hand, You're wide open to all sorts of suggestions. That ultimately, what I've learned now is that if somebody has a great idea, I don't care where it comes from, I'm going to get the credit for it as a director. So I've learned to yes, you have to have a healthy ego. Yes, you have to. There has to be one vision to get everybody down the field and complete the mission. But it is a collective effort. It is a community effort. And so I have. I've parked the ego, and really embraced the village to get the job done. I would say that's the real difference between now and 20, 30-some years ago.
I wasn't going to bring up the time, except to say we're out of it, and I can't thank you enough for doing this. And please come back and do
this
show.
Thank you. I will
again.
Indeed. Thank you. It's such a pleasure to meet you finally. I've been following you and the work that you were doing with Jason Reitman and doing it at the LACMA readings. And you're a real talented cat, and we're lucky to have you here in L.A.
That's very kind of you to say. My guest, who's a talented cat himself, is the star, director, and writer of The Public, Amelia Estevez. The show is recorded here at NPROS by Marcia Caldwell. It's edited, and she's going to have a lot of work by Blake Veit, who's associate producer. It's mixed by Kat Yore. I feel like tomatoes right now. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.